John Hell is my name. A Season in Hell, the name of the show. It is about, oh, I don't know, 843 here in San Francisco, 87.9 in San Francisco and Los Angeles, 104.8 in Berlin, and online at PirateCatRadio.com. I have in the studio somebody I haven't seen in so long, and I love her to death. And we met doing radio.
That's
when I was
met.
Doing radio. Blake Moore is in the studio. Good evening.
Hello. It's
How
nice to be here.
How are you?
I'm doing really good.
I believe that.
Uh-huh.
You look it.
Thank you.
Absolutely. So you do so many things.
It's true.
You do. You when I met you, you came into Radio Free Burning Man and said, "May I read some poetry?" Of course you could read some poetry, and just blew my mind. Next day, you're doing like naked yoga with about like 100 people out there that you're like doing a yoga class for. You're a performance artist. You're art car owner and enthusiast. Self-described dork. What the hell is that about?
Definitely.
I was looking at your website. I mean, I knew that, but so.
And also, I'm getting into video.
That's right. You have a film here.
Been doing. Yeah, this is what I'm going to be showing at the Ask Dr. Hal Show. On October 8th.
Right on, next Monday night.
So I've been doing poem shorts is the thing that I've kind of gotten into lately because I like combining the visual with the, yeah, combining the visual with the spoken word.
Right.
And they're not, it's not like a, it's more like a music video in the sense, but you don't see me performing it. It's all the visuals that go along with the poem.
Called Sunshine.
Sushi Me, actually.
There's no N in there. Sushi Me.
Sushi Me.
I love it. So, because our listening audience is wondering, why the heck is she on the air tonight?
Yeah, really, what's she doing here?
What are you doing? Like, give us a little bit of background. You've been writing for how long? Where did you get your, what's your background with writing?
I was an economics major in school, and I have been writing. I became a writer kind of randomly. I didn't know what I was going to do. I was a corporate person, and I just kind of gave it up because I realized that I needed to follow my soul, and these earphones keep falling off. Yeah, and so in following my soul, I realized that my soul spoke poetry, and I think poetry, out of all the things that I do, that's my first real love.
Okay.
Yeah, that's my...
Right, and did that come to you, like when you were in college studying economics, or did that come to you even as a youth? Were you writing a lot?
No, I actually hated writing when I was a youth. It really came about when I was in my very early 20s and I started dating a painter. And he got up in the morning and drank, nice coffee and went out surfing and then came back and painted in his studio. And I thought, wow. And I would put on my suit and drive to San Mateo. And I thought, what am I doing? And he one time told me I was communicating all the time. Why don't you just get a pen? And I did. And I got a pen and started writing and went, ah, I'm a poet. And I initially decided I was going to be a philosopher. And then we were on a road trip to Mexico, a surfing trip in Baja. And we met some people somewhere. And they asked me what I did. And I said I was a writer. Because, you have to try things on when you first get started. And, yeah.
I am looking at this fabulous video here. Radio is such not the video medium.
No.
Sorry for you folks.
And I think I was, you try things on. Like, for me saying I'm a, working on a filmmaker, I've made two. So the idea being, all right, well, I've made two. But you say you are, just because that way, the more you say it, the more true it becomes. So I told these people that I was a writer. And then I said I was a philosopher. And they started asking me what philosophies I'd read. And I really hadn't read a lot. And they pretty much shamed me into being a poet. At least as a poet, I didn't have to quote everybody else. It could be my own philosophy. And so that's what I did. I quit my corporate job and I got a computer. I had my car stolen and used half the money to buy a computer and the other half to buy a Karma Ghia.
Yeah.
And I was off.
And that Karma Ghia, what's her name?
Her name's Zezzy the Girl, and I actually let her go. And my second art car is named Eartha Car, and I wanted a car that would run on biodiesel. So I went ahead and let go of Zez, which was very sad.
So what is Eartha Car?
Eartha is a 1978 Mercedes. It's a 300 CD.
Okay.
Two-door. Kind of like the old, Century 21 luxury car.
Sure.
From the 70s. Yeah.
Yeah, I had a 77 D.
Yeah.
Yeah, slow.
Slug.
200D.
Oh,
slowest
God.
Car.
Slow
so did Jim
awful.
Mason help you
no,
biodiesel?
No. It is biodiesel. With a diesel engine, if you use biodiesel, you can just put biodiesel directly in.
Okay,
and you, when you first do it, you have to change your fuel filters more frequently because it's a you know, I guess it's like biodiesel acts as a laxative.
Ah.
Flushes out all the impurities.
Hey,
so
okay.
It gets gook everywhere. So you want to make sure, you know, you change your pants, yeah. So to speak.
Were you a reader growing up?
Yes.
Like,
yes.
Even as a youth, yeah, you were an avid reader?
Yeah.
What kind of things were you reading?
Growing up, mostly, you know, one of the books I remember is The Mixed Up Files of Mrs. I can never remember her name exactly. Something B. Frankenfurter. And I liked kind of fantasy books, you know, like The Secret Garden and Charlotte's Web. And then I got really into the Judy Blume books.
I was just going to ask the, are you there, God? Did you?
Oh, Are You There, God? It's me, Margaret. And do you remember what the name of the one for the boy was? What about the erection?
I read it, but I can't even remember the name.
Yeah, I was trying to remember that name the other day.
What was that, fifth grade or something like that?
Yeah, fifth grade. Yeah. But that was the one where, you know, she talked about boys going through puberty and, you know, being embarrassed when they got in front of the class. And that was the book that made me start looking. Like whenever the guys would get up in class, I was like, oh, maybe he's got one of those boners. You know? And so I totally, it was like, and I heard that her daughter's writing now.
Oh, that's true. Yeah. Yes, yes, yes.
Yeah.
So how about in your late
And then in college, you know, I went from being kind of that more conservative person. And then I ended up hooking up with a guy when I was in college. And kind of, it's funny, like men had these really great influences on propelling me into new directions. And he turned me on to Hunter S. Thompson and King Kesey and Tom Wolfe and that whole, you know, bank of writers, Kerouac and Ginsberg. And I think at that point, and also, you know, the drugs and that go along with it. And I just kind of started expanding my vocabulary and my interest in other things and kind of really got more into, you know, the mystery of life.
Sure. What were you doing at that time other than going to school? Were you working? Were you just sort of, did you have a direction at that time?
No, I did have a direction, but I changed my direction. My direction was politics. When I was in high school, I was student body president. And then I was, you know, I hate saying this because it's always so shocking, but I was on the Reagan Bush advance team in 1984, for the, you know, the 4 more years. And my boyfriend at the time, for my high school sweetheart, his sister was on Air Force One, traveling around with the advance team for the Reagans. She actually later did she curated the Reagan Library, and it's still, like, I guess Nancy, you know, wishes she were her daughter, kind of thing, kind of funny. But she asked me if I wanted to work for them, and I did. So my freshman year of college, I was answering phones in the presidential suite with Reagan and Bush and Nancy and Barbara and the Secret Service guys. And
I was
right there. I was making tea and answering the phone. Yeah. Yeah.
Was that like, were there some wow moments for you then? Like,
you know, I think
I could
it's
be
like,
a part of this.
It's funny. I think there were wow moments, but what I remember more was kind of shooting the shit with the CIA guys, you know, like in the back, because they were so cool, like, you know, but really, like there was an irreverence that I enjoyed because I've always been a little irreverent. And so I could be in that environment acting proper in my suit, but then I could say something wrong to one of those guys, or they'd say something wrong to me, and we could riff back and forth. And I thought, wow, you know. And I think what I saw more than anything was power was maybe not all of us cracked up to be.
Did it appear to be arbitrary? Like, was power kind of an arbitrary
thing?
Yeah,
and I wasn't that impressed with them as people. Like, oh, I'm
Bushes and Reagans?
Yeah, okay. It wasn't, you know, I remember not being starstruck.
Yeah.
That's what I remember. And then in college, I thought I was going to be political science, and then I joined the Government Internship Association, and then I spent one semester of my junior year in D.C. working on the Hill for Pete Wilson. Oh, you know who he is.
Former governor.
Oh, God. Yeah.
Good God.
And he was the reason why I got out of politics and left the Republican Party for good. Yeah.
Was that while he was governor?
No, he was the senator of California.
Oh, that's true. That's right. He was.
Yeah.
That's
and
right.
I ended up in his press office. And that was where I really got my start writing, because I found myself, you know, that's where I ended up. You know, you go in and there's all these interns that are there to work for those 3 months.
Yeah.
And they, you know, you take tests and you say what you want to do. And I ended up in the press intern, and it was great. I was writing releases. And then, but then I realized, you know, how his whole press staff made fun of him. You know, like, they talked about getting the hook out when he was speaking, and don't let him go on too long. And he was like a buffoon to them. And I was a little surprised by how, you know. And then he did something kind of weird in the coffee shop, like in the coffee room. He made some kind of comment to me that I just thought was gross. And I was like, yeah, a little bit, you know. He didn't touch me or anything. And it wasn't really that inappropriate, but it was enough where I was like, you know, if I had taken the bait.
He was testing the waters.
Exactly.
He was testing the waters. Very, very carefully. It reminds me, what was that movie? John Travolta playing the Clinton, basically.
Uh-huh.
There's that whole scene about, like, you know, he and the young black girl down in Arkansas, a friend of the family, and he's just testing the waters with her, and she takes the bait. It's like, I think it's called True Colors, actually.
Yeah, I think it is. Yeah, you know, he flirted with my mom.
Bill Clinton?
Yeah. Yeah, my mom's from Arkansas also.
Bill.
And, yeah, and then there was my mom's big joke. Is
shameless.
It was my mom's friend is some political person for the state of Arkansas, and they were having a big party for Labor Day weekend, and, you know, he went in and used the toilet, and my mom was, like, the next one after it, you know, so it was like, oh, I've been on the same toilet as him. And, you know, it was like this funny, weird toilet joke that went on. This is all pre, you know.
Can I flush for you?
Yeah, exactly.
Do you need somebody to help you wipe? wink, 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 just joking. Have a nice night, Navy.
Hey, that made me think of a poem of like my changing life.
Yes,
this is called, it's called Waking Up in a Past Life, and it's from my new book that is called God Meat, and I have my galley here. It hasn't gone to press yet.
God Meat,
it's coming. Yeah, God Meat, M-E-A-T.
I'm part of Cat Radio.
And it is going to be out, Beatitude Press. And I have a reading at the North Beach Library on the 13th of November. So that's my deadline, that the book's got to be in my hand. So I need to get to the printer this week. And
no kidding.
This is my third galley, and I keep finding mistakes. So I'm terrified to let it go. It's like, no.
Yeah, you know? At some point, you have to do that.
Well, I mean mistakes, like dumb mistakes, typos. I've had two different people, three people's eyes on it, and they keep finding things. So
okay, that's like, why they're looking at it.
So this is the first poem in the book, and it's called Waking Up in a Past Life. I opened my eyes to bums howling, crackling, dragging their cardboard beds into doorways. Fancy boutique ones that don't open till noon. The sky reaching into strands of lip and persimmon. Spread wide with faraway blackbirds. Spread wide with faraway blackbirds. I am already tired. My vision close to the senseless waste of minds, especially mine. A headline of corned beef. Does it pop? Do I really want mothers to trust Nestle again? Why not go all the way, sleep in alleys, scrape off calluses with knives, eat pizza crust out of North Beach dumpsters, laugh and drink and piss on concrete? I could paint apocalyptic pictures, sing the sidewalk blues, recite into space. I want someone like me, lost, searching, hungry for purpose, to buy me cognac at Specs, touch my shoulders, listen to my seventh dimensional underpinnings. I am a shaman in bum's clothing, alive on the razor between jail and liver failure, staring at the frat boy as he kicks me into the hospital, telling the cop, it'll be okay. In the next life, he will be forgiven. But now I'm getting dressed in corporate drag. Sheer pantyhose, low heels, trim skirt, light cleavage. I have a corner office cubicle, a meeting at 2 with a potential client, a first date with a weightlifter from the gym. The type who'll take me to a place with big portions so he can rib me about my tiny appetite. Our mouths constantly moving in nowhere conversation. Maybe I'll get laid. Come home with a wax box of leftovers to leave as an offering to the street.
So in there earlier, you were talking, you used the word again. Did I hear that word? Did you say the word again, early on? Something about...
Maybe I'm already tired?
Yeah, I think that was it. Maybe it just came into my mind. I mean, maybe I have somebody speaking to me behind. Maybe I have a
earpiece in. What did they say about again? It was those Secret Service guys.
Yeah, right. I think what was coming to my mind here was Have you experienced this?
This is my life. I lived in North Beach, and I remember looking out my window, and I was driving to a job, and I saw a bum scraping calluses off his feet. Yeah. And I was just, you know, like, what am I doing this for? And it's parts of life. Like, I worked when I was driving in a suit. There's different parts of my life that are tied in, because I worked for an advertising agency and did PR, and my very first, an agency started a new PR department and asked me to head it up, and it was called Lewis and Company, and it was, you know, in that area by Battery and Sansom.
Oh yeah. Oh yeah.
And
Central.
And I was, you know, like, that was going to be, you know, I was really confused when I graduated from college. I didn't know what I wanted to do. I was an economics major, you know, after getting out of politics, I went into economics, and then all my friends were becoming investment bankers and accountants and right out of college and getting married. And I was like, well, this is not what I want to do. What am I going to do? And so I ended up getting a work visa abroad through the Government Internships Association that I'd worked with, and went to London, and ostensibly to go work for the London School of Economics, which I did not end up doing, but to go to school, because I was I was studying the privatization trends in Great Britain, so my politics hadn't quite changed. And when I got to England, and when I was in London, I interviewed for a couple of investment banking type jobs, and I actually was experienced one of the kind of classic 80s treatment of women in the finance world, where I went through, I think it was my third interview, and it was a Bond Street building, a big high rise. I remember it was late afternoon. I'm up there, and there's three men, and I was in my early 20s. They were in their mid. I was 20, I think, because I graduated when I was 20 from college, and I went right after. And you know, mid 40s, kind of jowly, little paunchy, and they were talking to me. You know, it's kind of going fine. And mind you, like, you know, this is like the super LA kind of California girl kind of look too. You know, and one of the guys asked me if I liked myself, and I said, "Well, yeah, I like myself." And he says, "Well, do you like yourself enough to masturbate in front of a mirror?" And I was like, just like, what, your face right there? Like, what? What are they saying? And I sometimes...
Only at the Folsom Street Fair.
I'm not... Yeah, exactly. I'm...
Okay, with about 50 people watching me. That's all I know.
Did that happen? Did you go this?
I did go yesterday, and I have a story to share, okay, but later.
That's so funny. But... Sometimes I'm quick on my feet, you know, especially when I'm inspired. You know, if it's just like dumb stuff, I'm not as fast. And I just looked at him and said, "Yeah, do you?" And that experience made him kind of lean back, and his other friends kind of looked at him like, "Ha ha, she just got you," you know?
Right.
And, you know, they ended up offering me the job, and I didn't take it.
Yeah,
and
right
on. I was like, "I'm not going to do this." And I ended up getting a job waitressing in Covent Gardens.
Jeez.
And I was making, you know, £60 a night, which at those days, like, that was like $120. That was good money. And I loved it there. And then I kind of, like, that's when my creativity started really coming forward, you know.
Brilliant. Blake Moore is in the studio, Pirate Cat Radio. John Hell's my name, A Season in Hell, about 5 minutes after the hour of 9 o'clock. Ice Cream Lopez will be making her way here in just a little bit. We're going to take a quick break, play a little song. The stories are remarkable. I mean, they just, they flow. They flow. No wonder you're a writer.
Yeah, really.
Going back to 1991. We're going to be listening to, oh boy, I'm sorry. I'm loving that story that you're sharing. So that's like too much for me. We're going to go back to, I didn't do it, I swear. Swerve Driver is the name of the band. The CD is called Raise. This is Rave Down on Pirate Cat Radio. Swerve Driver. Swerve Driver on Pirate Cat Radio, 87.9 FM.
Hi.
Hello.
Scream
Lopez has made it to the station, ladies and gentlemen. Pirate Cat Radio.
The house.
And Blake Moore is here, and that was a little Swerve Driver action off of Raze. We've been reading some poetry, telling amazing stories.
Let's talk about Blake's outfit.
Yeah, what are you wearing? These are license plates.
It's pretty hot. Yeah.
You know, I'm kind of like fresh from the Art Car Fest, so this is these are my, I call them my Sagger bloomers.
Yeah.
Bloomers.
Yeah, you know what they're made from? Can you tell?
They look like they're made from boxers.
They're boxers. Nine pair of boxers went into these.
Sweet.
So, yeah.
I have an art car.
Her second one.
This shirt came to me. Yeah, and this shirt came to me because one of the, Joanna, who's from L.A., and they were in the hollow, her and her friend were in the Halloween car, her and her friend Sassy. And Joanna had this on Sunday morning, and I looked, it's an old polyester 70s shirt with license plates.
It's a button down Oxford. Very nice, with a pointed collar.
Pointed collar and these license plates and cars. And I told her, wow, that's such a nice shirt. And she said, I want you to have it, and took it off right
love
there.
That. Don't
and
you
gave
love
it to
those
me. I'm
gifts?
Like, no.
Took it off right there.
She took it off there right there. Rules. Yeah, and all the guys thank me because she's really beautiful. Like, hey, thanks. She took her top off and everything.
You're hot, and you're wearing it now. So everybody said, hey, thanks. You're hot, and you're
rocking
it now.
Totally. It was awesome.
That's a beautiful experience. Two beautiful ladies in the studio. Ice Cream Lopez is a seamstress.
Oh, so that's why you noticed.
Stress the stress.
Of the
stress right now.
If I give either of you all of my ties, will you make a suit for me? Because I don't wear ties.
One long tie.
And I have about 200
funny.
That I will never wear.
I've been doing ties lately, and I usually am wearing one. I have a line called Tai Chi. And so I've been taking ties and funking them out and
really?
Embellishing them and doing all this weird stuff to them.
Oh.
And
I want a suit made out of my ties. I've already laid them out. Now listen to this. I've already laid.
Okay, that's.
But I have to explain. I've already laid them out. I've already laid them out.
The stress
by length. I've already taped them together.
Whoa.
And I when it comes to sewing, I would need an Uber like machine to really do the job.
See, the
especially
best,
with all that tape.
The best thing to because that's sticky gooey mess.
Right.
There's extra. There's extra.
It's on the inside. So it's
that's
you
it.
Know whatever.
All sides.
Okay.
The best thing is lay it all out like a piece of fabric,
yeah,
which you have done, and then you can lay whatever pattern on top of that. So you have it about 1/32nd, 1/16th of a way there.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Getting back to your book, what is the name of it?
It's called God Meat.
And when do you, what's the publisher?
Beatitude Press.
San Francisco?
Beatitude, I don't know if anyone's heard of Bob Kaufman. Do you know anything about the beat lore?
Yes, but I don't know about
Bob Kaufman is considered the real grandfather of the Beats.
Oh.
And there's this wonderful old story that he was a black man, North Beach, home street poet, and, you know, wild and intense and full of wisdom. And he used a lot of humor. And the rumor has it that Kaufman and Kerouac and Ginsberg were all together in Greenwich Village on mushrooms. And there was this, you know, wild expression going on between the three of them. And Kaufman went to Ginsberg and did the, you know, forehead to forehead thing and said, you are the one to take it. And then, you know, they all went. So, like, he was, like, considered, like, maybe the guru to the gurus, you know?
Wow.
And the hidden guru. And I encountered his wife, Elaine, and Kaufman's dead. But I ended up working with the poet, Tony Seymour. Some years ago, I did a poetry play called Godzilla versus Swan Blake with Tony. And Tony was, when he was 17, had met Kaufman in North Beach and kind of was, you know, one of Kaufman's. He stayed with Kaufman the rest of Kaufman's life. And so because of that, I got tied into this world. And H.D. Moe is currently working with Beatitude and he asked me about a year and a half ago. He came to Point Arena. I run a poetry series in Point Arena, and he came up to read. And he has been bugging me ever since to get a book together. And because I've been focusing on video, I have been falling behind. And plus, you know, connecting with Chris, buying property, my whole life, kind of like all the things that I normally do. Poetry, I did my last book 4 years ago. And so that's kind of that's a long stretch between books. That's why this one's 130 pages.
That's great.
Which is, and it's got poetry and prose and artwork as well. So
it's a lot to absorb.
It's a lot to absorb.
So give our listeners a little background. Where your move up to Point Arena, where you were before. Like, so where we were before the break was, you're talking about your experience in the corporate world, being in London, working with the Bush and Reagan.
Yeah.
Hello. Crazy.
Weird stuff.
And so now, like, what let's.
Yeah, now I live in the woods, you know, it's a totally different world. I left San Francisco. Well, it's funny. I went to Japan when I came back from England. I traveled in the Middle East from there. Like, I left the corporate world and then went and got in a lorry truck and drove with 10 people from England all the way to the tip of Egypt, to the Sudan border. And we camped the whole way. And there was a period of time when we were in Syria and we're going through, we didn't have no roads, just the deserts of Syria with a compass. And once we were, you know, these Bedouins encountered us and stopped us and took us to their Bedouin tents and fed us. And, you know, they always, and everywhere we went, you know, we'd meet these people with, you know, gold teeth. And they'd see us and they'd climb their oasis palm tree and come down with a huge brick of hash, you know, like crazy.
Now they're all, you're CIA.
Well, no, they know. But so, like, the idea being is just like, it was such a wild time. And I met all these people, all these brown people that were so cool and interesting and great communicators. And I was just like, well, where am I, you know? And I came back, and my college sweetheart asked me to marry him.
The Republican?
No, he was the one who turned me on to Kinkesi.
Okay.
What happened with him and I is he's the one who turned me on to acid and, like, freedom. And he was a fourth-year freshman when we got together. Let's just say that. He was a fourth-year freshman. Yeah, super slacker. And I think because I was so motivated, like, it gave him, he became motivated. And so I left. I graduated before he did. He was a year older than me. I graduated and he stayed behind. And so I was gone for a year. When I came back, he like did his 3 years, like in a year and a half, you know, like he really moved to get through. And he asked me to marry him, and he was from Tiburon. So we moved up here, which is how I ended up. Nope.
No. Okay.
Nope. I didn't do it. Yeah. He was a beautiful man, though, and he treated me so well. I just wasn't really ready to get married. I was still really, it's taken me a long time to figure out who I am, and it just changes. It constantly changes. And so being with it, you know, another person, I've been pretty much mostly flying solo my whole life. And Chris and I have been together for 4 years now, and it's the longest I've ever been with anyone.
Chris
too, both of us. Yeah, exactly. We're both equally, you know.
I think anybody who knows the two of you are happy and very surprised.
And surprised. Well, when we first hooked up, we're like, hey, he's like, him and Herod had this thing about being toxic bachelors. I guess their Oprah had something going on, and Oprah had said, you know, oh, any guy who's this certain age without this kind of relationship is a toxic bachelor. And he told me that. I'm like, well, I'm a toxic bachelorette for sure. And so So our idea was, you know, this isn't going to work. So let's just enjoy each other. Because it's not going to work. You know, we both know that. So what? And it's...
It hasn't worked now for 4 years.
Yeah, exactly.
Congratulations.
And we bought property together. So now it's like we're married anyway. Uh-oh. So that's the thing that... But we were smart, though. Before we bought property, we even did our prenuptial. Like how we'd split it. If we split, we did all that.
That's smart.
Yeah. Yeah. Why you like each other is the time to do it. Yeah.
No, we're just talking.
Yes, but use the microphone. Because this is called radio.
Don't wanna.
Okay.
And but what was I saying?
So you're talking about being in the Middle East.
I ended up coming. Yeah, the Middle East, and then I came up here, and I ended up when I became a writer. Okay, remember I said I sold my car, and then I got the other car, and then my car was stolen. I used insurance money to get the computer and another and half down payment on a computer and a car. So like you can tell, the computer was a little bit fancier, and the. I lived in North Beach, and I tried to get work, and I couldn't.
Around what year?
I left for Japan in 92. Okay. So this is that kind of period right there. And what happened is, as I was freelancing, and I had like one of my first clients, I was a nonprofit. I work with nonprofits doing brochures and newsletters. So I took that PR stuff and tried to apply it into do-gooding. Yeah. And I had work, but it doesn't pay. It's like teaching. You know, there's certain jobs that just don't pay. And
that's right.
Do-gooding isn't really one of the highest paying jobs in our current culture. And so I was like, okay, I'm going to waitress. I'm going to do something, you know. And I got the newspaper out and I saw an ad, teach English in Japan. I was all... I have that job. And I really did. Like, I put on my shortest hot pants. And it was in the, you know, this is like the early 90s, right? Remember those thigh-high boots that were really popular? I had like a suede pair of thigh-high boots, you know, and something. And I went to the address. I was like, I'm not sending in a resume. I'm going to the door and I'm knocking because I wanted to get out. You know, I didn't know what I was going to do. And this seemed like my goal. And so I did. And the guy hired me. And like a week later, I was putting all my stuff in storage. I drove a Ryder truck. My parents are from LA and my dad has an airplane, so we had an airplane hangar. So I put all my stuff in my dad's hangar, my car and everything. So it was a really easy for me to get rid of all my stuff and was on a plane like a week later. Oh. And I found out that the guy who hired me only hired people who came in person. So like my intuition was just firing. Like I was really supposed to be there. And I got there and it was kind of the school was called Mike's English School, and they had like 30 different teachers. It was like 15 English speakers, always American, and 15 Japanese, and they hooked them up together. And I had to wear a red blazer with the Mike's English School patch, a little bear on it.
Uniform.
You know? Yeah, and a black tie. And I just hated it. I was working 35 hours a week, and here I'd been like freelancing and not working for anyone. And so they sent me to Korea to get my final visa, and I came back because you have to work there 3 months, and they send you out of the country. And then they give you your work visa. And I came back. So now I've got my work visa, which meant I could work anywhere. I didn't have to stay at Mike's English School. And I went to the president of the company and I said, listen, I'm not cut out for this work. It's just not for me. I was teaching like preschool age to 90.
And how long had you been there?
When I said that. And he said, I told him, I said, the problem is you have really terrible communication between your staff and your Americans. They need a training manual. So will you let me do a training manual for you and let me out of my contract? So I became staff copywriter is what he called me. That was his name for me, which I wasn't writing copy, but that's, and then he used me as a consultant. So whenever he had a letter or anything, and I was in Japan for 3 years and he was like one of my highest paying gigs. And then I used that, but I couldn't keep the free apartment. So I had to go, and I had met this friend, and my friend had a 4.5 to Tommy Matt room with a cockroach the size of my foot in it, you know, and there was just like, there wasn't even a sink. There was this one little kind of weird toilet that wasn't even a toilet. You know, like the toilets in Japan at that time to me was like, what? This is just a trough. That's not a toilet. And I took my resume around and started getting work. And I had my first cover story. I paid off all my student loans my first year of being there. And that's when I really kind of took my wings came as a writer. I realized that this is what I like doing.
Did you learn any Japanese?
Skoshi des. I think I mostly learned sushi shop Japanese.
Right.
Yeah.
Of course.
Because
how to get yourself around, basically.
Yeah, and because I was writing so much, I had, you know, I was doing like 6 feature stories, like 3,000 word stories a month.
What were you writing and who were you writing for?
I was writing cultural stuff mostly, and I was writing for Tokyo Time Out and Nippon Journal, Tokyo Times.
So you had taken your resume to all these places in Tokyo, the Times, and people spoke English there, so you were able to say hi.
Oh, yeah, because
I'm American, and did you have to present some of your work, or did
yeah,
you just
that's
show
exact, exactly what I did. I presented my work at a portfolio with some of the stuff that I published, and I went, and they're an international magazines based in Japan for the, 'cause there's kind of a large gaijin population. And so, and
you
I think
found them.
Yeah. And
hey.
I went around and found them. I was so hungry.
You took off your red blazer.
Yeah, but I think then when I got to Japan, I was really into, you know, shaving my head and coloring my hair, weird stuff. Like I went through a really like super, like just more just alternative butch kind of phase where I just didn't, I liked that people didn't know if I was a boy or a girl. I was really
You went through a huge transformation in a 10-year period of time is what it sounds like, because you had gone from your kind of right-leaning roots to all of a sudden going, wait, time out. There is, excuse me, a whole lot here that I was never told about that I'm having to experience on my own. And I'm really interested in kind of exploring that just a little bit. Kind of like, what was it about your experience? Was it your experience in England in the corporate sector that made you say this isn't everything that it seems to be? Or,
well, I mean, I think the England, just I only had that interview and then I never was in the
right.
corporate section.
Oh,
so
right,
my experience
right.
in England was waitressing.
That's right.
And then the traveling in the Middle East. I just think that travel opens your mind up. And I think my mind, I saw so many different ways of living.
Yeah, you're in your 20s. So you were a sponge.
I was totally a sponge. I was like, it's just absorbing it and seeking out as much as I could. And I think when I came back to San Francisco before I went to Japan, that's when I really tried to do my corporate thing. Like I got a job at Oracle, and a friend of mine was risk manager, and she asked me to, yeah. And so she said that there was this really great corporate, it was like a finance training rotation. And what it was like the elite of Oracle, where they were training you to be managers, upper managers. And it was when they were building the corporate headquarters. I think there was only like a building and a half.
But sure, so I used to live right down the street.
Yeah, so
watch that entire campus
bingo.
Be built.
Yeah,
over like
it's amazing.
5 years.
Chris took me there like maybe a year and a half ago, and I was like, and oh my god,
they run the entire
Allison
town.
Is really now. Into Japanese culture, so your background with Japan.
Well, I hadn't been to Japan yet.
Oh. Wow.
There
so it was one of those things where I got hired. I got hired. I think they made me interview like 8 times. And I was from UCLA, which was really kind of podunk to Oracle. Like I wasn't an Ivy League school. And I think at the time they were hiring a lot of brown people, like people from Brown University.
Brown people from Brown.
No, I think it was Brown University.
Should I be offended?
Is that affirmative action thing?
And so I got the job, and I lasted in that job for 3 months. And that was the when I said I was driving from, you know, down at Ocean Beach. I was with that surfer who was painting and drinking coffee and hanging out, and like seemed like he had this really chill life. And he drove he had a little convertible Mercedes. And I was like, how is he doing this? I found out later he was growing pot, but I didn't know that at the time. You know,
yeah.
It's one of those like, oh, well. And so I quit. I said, I can't do this. But I was after, I think the last thing that happened, because I was literally in the same floor as Larry Ellison and the controller, because what our job was to shadow the people that were leading the company. And through shadowing them, you know, you determine where you really fit.
Right.
And then they groom you to be, you know, and I was doing really well. I remember we had a dinner and it was, you know, just kind of everybody started drinking and getting a little crazier. And I was just, I was really cocky. You know how you are when you don't know as much? I think I'm less cocky now, you know, because I know. But then I had a mouth on me and I wasn't afraid to say stuff. And like all the, you know, like the executive guy types really thought, whoa, she's crazy, you know, and they enjoyed it. So it gave me power. And I think it was the Secret Service guys, you know, like those guys trained me for a kind of understanding.
During the Bush years. Pardon me, the Reagan years.
They gave me a kind of understanding. And I think that I was doing cartwheels down the hall one day, and I was wearing purple suits and stuff. Like I was trying to break out, but I didn't know how, you know, but I was wanted to have money too. So it was like the torn thing, you know? And when I was cartwheeling down the hall, I came, you know, back and sat back at my desk, and my boss brought me in and said inappropriate corporate behavior. And I was just like, whoa, I don't think I belong in a corporation.
Were you having thoughts in your mind, like being pulled, like, because you just made a comment about the money, the lifestyle, ooh, that sure is attractive. But at the same time, were you having like ethical issues in your mind? Like,
oh, like I told
you. It's just not me.
Well, my that PR job I had, the first thing, the guy gave me my first client, and it was Nestle. And it was during the milk thing.
Oh, my.
It was during the milk thing. And here I'm writing an article of why Nestle's good, because it's PR, right?
Yeah.
So I'm not talking about the milk thing, but talking about the other thing. So it was, you know, awful. And I couldn't reconcile that. And I ended up going to it was called Aid to the Adoption of Special Children. And it was these couple called the DeBolts. You remember that movie from the 70s with Henry Winkler?
What was it called?
Who were the DeBolts and where did they get 14 children?
No.
Anyway, it's like this couple that... Do you remember? Do you know who Henry Winkler is?
Yeah, of course, the Fonz.
Okay. He was a documentary.
Was it that after school special that the guy that lived in the wall and he wouldn't leave
like
and all that shit?
4:30.
What was that one called? I loved
doing
it. Do
your
you
homework.
The,
well, you're something supposed to be doing your homework.
Was Boy in the Bubble wasn't the.
What's that one where the family family moves out of the house and he stays and he lives in the crawl space and like a new family moves in and he stays there and all he does is watch them. It's a really like well known cult film now, but it was an after school special.
Oh, yeah.
Anyway, let's go back to the Henry Winkler film and Nestle.
Doing your homework.
Yeah, yeah. You were doing your homework back then. You weren't watching.
I wasn't. Yeah. I actually.
Your homework, I bet.
I'll tell you, when I was in UCLA, I didn't do my homework. I actually didn't even go to class. I bought lecture notes.
Oh!
I was a lecture note buyer, and I was a crammer. I was so bad that I had nightmares for years after college. It was like, nightmares.
My only nightmares are dead air.
Hero.
That's it.
Yeah, I can see why.
Yeah, that's, oh, God, is there music? All right, go on. I want
so
they took you in. They taught you improper corporate behavior.
Oh, is that what I was talking
that
about?
That was your last fight. And then the Nestle. And,
Nestle.
Yeah, yeah.
I had asked you about that whole dialectic that you were experiencing.
Yeah, so it's kind of like when it all goes in, there is a linear timeline, but there's so many overlaps that it becomes so circular. And I think that it was all leading to saying, you know, just let go and live life. And so somehow I think I've been really, really lucky, really, you know, there's an area where the discipline, I'm very disciplined. So maybe between my discipline and good fortune, you know, there's kind of something, cause like the way it happened in Japan was really there is an element of luck. Cause it's like, I saw that and I went and, you know, I was the first one, that kind of thing.
But coupled with that luck was a lot of hard work.
Yeah.
You were prepared. You brought your resume. You knew who to talk to when.
Organized,
disciplined,
so,
and smart.
Coupled with luck, there's always the hard work and determination
that's
that
right.
goes with it.
Totally.
I agree.
Huh. Totally. Yeah. Like, I don't think it's all just luck, but I just think that there's an element of some of that stuff that to me is unexplicable. Like, some things that have happened. Like, because there, when I was in Japan, you know, I just would meet someone. I'd suddenly be at a club and I'd meet someone. He's like, oh, yeah, I'm in the editor for Tokyo Time Out. I'm like, really? I'm a writer. You know, like something like that. Hi, can I make an appointment and come see you on Monday? He's like, sure, you know, and ended up Tokyo Time Out was really a great, it was like the city mag. It was, you know, it was a monthly, more glossy. I don't know if there's anything like that, but everybody waited for it every month.
Oh,
kind of like
San
the
Francisco
week.
San Francisco Magazine.
Is it?
For the elitist, I mean the bourgeois, I mean the rich. I mean,
yeah, but this wasn't even for. I mean, everyone in Tokyo in the middle '90s that spoke English was kind of a bourgeois elitist because we were all making so much money that we could afford the glossy magazine, you know. And I had my first cover story there. It was called Jammin' in Japan, and it was all about the reggae, you know, the Jamaican influence that was going on, and I just like. Just loved it, you know. It all opened up for me and started having. And I have a poem about Japan.
Let's hear it.
This is like a good segue into that.
On Pirate Cat Radio, Blake Moore in the studio.
And this is called Odakusen at Rush Hour. Do you know what the Odakusen is? It's a train. It's one of the blue lines.
Oh, I thought it was like the guys on the train when they're so packed so tightly, they're squeezing the chicks' asses and all that, and nobody
maybe
they have a name too. They have a word for that.
There is a name, but that's you're funny. You're like almost psychic.
Oh.
So the Odakusen is the blue line that goes from Shibuya to Shinjuku, and then. And then to the west. It's like the west line. And I lived in Shimokitazawa, which was kind of like the, I don't know, like I always said like the Venice Beach. But now everything's gone so gentrified. There's really no, you like the mission of Tokyo. I mean, whatever. It's like, are there any neighborhoods that are really still like super creative? It was like Shimokitazawa. It was where you see, you know, those books with all that crazy Japanese fashion.
Oh,
all
yes,
those
yes,
kids
yes.
were in
Fresh Fruits.
Yeah, all those kids were in the town. I lived in that section.
There were
bars that were smaller than the studio. You walk in, you know, there's one line, there's one bar and a guy behind it, and you sit there right on the train tracks. You know, like there's just something about that place. So this, I'm sorry, I'm setting the stage, which is not necessarily because this poem has nothing to do with that. Odakusin at rush hour. We are toilers pulled through the track of evening. Fingers crossed behind moving glass. Faithful, no one will stand out. Do something to embarrass culture. I am the smudge as I watch a salaryman, much shorter and older than I, press himself into a young office lady, rub his groin along the contours of her pink suit, smell the sable of black naped at her neck. She tries to move away, but has nowhere to go. It is 6 p.m. and we are minnows in a sea of flesh. He is the shark, her ass in hand, reaching under for the good meat. I watch her hand squeeze the dangling ring as her eyes lock on the floor in docile acquiescence. Where is your fight, girl? I want to shout. Do you like it? Anonymous old perv fingering your panties? I want to save her, even if she can't save herself. But I think of the time in Omotesando when I heard a woman whimpering, no, 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 at the end of a dark alley and ran to discover a black marine doing her against the wall, very much with her consent. The rape fantasy. I cannot take these limp people lined up in rows of blue, looking away or into newspapers with half-clad schoolgirls printed alongside financial reports. I am a gaijin superhero. I leap up, press myself between the two, my body forcing his hand back to his side. I grip the ring closest to his head and lean into him. I tower and glare. His anger meets my good deed. It's a stare down to the next stop, his face turning redder, more pinched, until the doors finally open, allowing him to escape into the masses, a new piece of office lady underwear already on his mind. The victim does not thank me. The other passengers continue to read or look away. I quietly remove my invisible cape and return to my former seat, my culture sticking out like a nail that won't get hammered down.
What's the... There's a name for those guys. Do you know what I'm talking about? There's an actual... There's an actual term for those men.
I don't remember the term.
Ugh, yeah. It's just so disgusting.
Do you know that saying, the culture, the nail that gets that sticks out gets hammered down? Have you ever heard that in reference to Japanese culture? That's what the Japanese say a lot, and that's the reason why, you know, they don't want to dress different, or they want to wear it. This is again, I'm talking about Japan in the mid 90s. So, you know, Japan, everything changes. So it could not be like that at all anymore. I haven't been back since 95. So I'm referring to an older Japan, but it was, like everybody said, the nail that sticks out gets hammered down. So we don't want to get hammered down. So that's the reference that I made in the poem.
Blake Moore is on A Season in Hell with John Hill and Ice Cream Lopez in the studio, Pirate Cat Radio, 87.9 FM. Online at piratecatradio.com, about 25 minutes in front of the hour of 10 o'clock. Very exciting. Excited to have you in the studio.
Gaijin means foreigner.
Oh, okay.
And it also, loosely translated, it means outsider also. So it's kind of foreigner, outsider.
That was the one word I didn't...
And I don't know if you get this about the newspapers, too. Looking into newspapers with half-clad schoolgirls printed alongside financial reports. Have you ever seen...
No.
I'm picturing the page 3 girl in England or something.
In truth, this is one of the things that shocked me, probably one of the first things that really shocked me a lot. Japan was amazing. It was like every day my jaw was dropping. It was incredible. And there was a something shocked, like made me think so hard that I was like, oh my God, my worldview has been changed again. And the Wall Street Journal... You know, you're flipping through the Wall Street Journal, and then suddenly there's like a girl, like maybe 18, she's barely 18, but she's dressed like a 12-year-old, and they call them the Bukuru outfits, the little Japanese schoolgirl outfits with a, you know, tit hanging out and the skirt kind of short, maybe lifting up her panties. Right. You know, next to the finance reports, next to the story about, you know, so it was like, this was all part of the newspaper. And like, here's like an old guy reading this, and I'm looking over at his shoulder, seeing this, you know, 18-year-old Bukuru outfit with the real 12-year-old in the Bukuru outfit right next to him. I was just like, oh my God, I don't know what
sick,
I'm seeing.
Sick fantasies. So, you know, as a matter of fact, I know in Japan, the pop singers, they'll put out like, books of pictures of the pop singer, like it'll be like 100 pages
with the black marks over there.
No, actually, from what I had seen, I'd never seen any nudity, yep. But it was all about still like, you know, the 18-year-old female pop singer, and yes, they might have her in a bikini. I'd never seen any nudity, but it was still like a very interesting thing. Like they made sure that they marketed them not just with the music, but with the fashion, and definitely little schoolgirl. I mean, that was like the whole concept was little schoolgirl.
So this is the new male Japanese fantasy instead of the geisha girl is the Japanese girl.
And I think some of what was going on in Japan was, you know, the Americans pretty much emasculated the Japanese culture with the dropping of the atom bomb, and then the later, you know, all the American GIs coming in and policing the country and rebuilding the country. And what happened is that suddenly the white woman ideal suddenly came in, and the Japanese guy couldn't really get the white woman. And then, I mean, it was just, and then all the Japanese women wanted the white guy. I mean, it just got all confused.
Yeah, and the emasculation.
The emasculation is pretty rough. Yeah. And I think, you know, there's a real club. Can I talk about, can I say whatever one I really can?
Whatever right?
I'm just
you
making
want.
Sure. There was a real club in Shinjuku that was like a diaper club. Have you heard about those? Like,
I'm assuming it's the guy dresses up
as a baby and poops his pants, and like there's like a whole like weird kind of baby cult thing going on, and I think that, you know, what I experience when you need that level of friction to get turned on, then there's like some major, like there's something. Like culturally, some of that stuff is so thick that there was a great book I read called Pink Samurai when I was there at the time. And I just like got some really, really, it's actually funny because, you know, that sushi movie, right, that I did, is about a poem that I wrote. And then when I was done with it, it's a poem about dinner for 20 people who eat sushi on me. And when I did the experience this last note, I actually had the dinner on 420 at the Oddfellow Lodge, because we have the Mendocino encampment 420, and we actually have purple fezes that say Mendocino 420 on them. Like,
that's
so
awesome.
Silly. And I know it's so much information that I'm just barely even, it's like fringe of ideas. It's like, oh, how do you tie them all together?
I just spend a weekend out there with you at your place.
Yeah, it's really fun.
Just hang out and walk through the woods and keep talking about all
yeah,
this.
Yeah, exactly.
Stuff. I'm seriously intrigued with more. I just want more.
We're actually watching.
Feed me.
Actually, we have the video playing here in the studio.
Hi.
So.
Yeah, and the video is really about the lead-in to the meal. It's about the four women who, it's about them, the experience. I don't do anything. I just lay there and they put sushi on me. And so the poem is all about, you know, them and what they're doing. And so like that line is, you know, yeah, anyway.
A lot of the Japanese culture too is not necessarily in the actual outcome of it. It's the preparation.
They put a wasabi
something.
On your toes?
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, it's wasabi.
Sorry
on my toes.
Sorry for cutting you off there. Go ahead. I want you to continue with what you're saying. No, go ahead.
And it's actually the preparation of doing something than the outcome or the actual act of something.
Yeah,
exactly.
Very good.
That's like
very
the
good.
Bonseki, like the sand drawing and the Ikebana. All of it is all about the doing more than it is the done.
Well, that's it should be the road versus the destination.
This is like, I wrote an article when I was in Japan about Bonseki, and that was like, you know, you do these elaborate, you spend, you know, maybe a day or more days on doing this beautiful painting with sand on a black lacquer tray, and then it's gone. You can't save it. And I remember I went and did it with these ladies, and I was so mad. I'm like, but it's pretty. I want to keep it. Can I spray something on it and hang it up? I'm like, yeah. And so this was like that. But this time, you know, by making a movie of it, this was from a poem actually that we did in 2000 during that place, that thing out in the desert that people do. That
is the poem on the back.
That's the poem on the back.
Read this.
I do in the movie. So, and I'm going to be showing it at the Dr. House show.
I show you deep.
It's a little excerpt from it, just the
it
audio.
All they allow as they balance raw sustenance on my ravenous skin, rendering me motionless beneath their tittering, slave at the banquet ledge, captive to every high domo moan of imagination.
Did you edit the film?
I edited the film, and for the most part, that song you heard is by Junior Shuba and the Ann Chung Project. And she, I found her on one of the Rough Cut guides. She's an Okinawan folk singer. And I wrote to her and sent her the video, and she said I could use it.
Oh, right on.
So she gave me permission to use her music. But all the rest of the music's all my own. Teasing. I composed 4 songs, and I did all the editing.
As well as laying there for how long?
It was about a 2-hour adventure.
Wow.
And you'll see at the end of it, like, I do the big surprise. Like, the ending is really fun because you really experience what it was. And Doug Wellman was one of the photographers. Doug Wellman and Cyberg did all the cinematography.
Doug's
for me.
The best because he's can be so focused and serious when he's working. And then when he's not working, he's very puzzling.
Did you get an itch anywhere? Would you be like, can you poke your
No, but
your
that wasabi
right
on my nipples, that wasabi is burns. The wasabi will burn. And wow, so it was really fun because I got to make everybody by saying that wasabi burns.
So hungry.
And how long did it take for the actual meal to happen? And, you know, because people are just having dinner. So it's this dinner with 10 people, it takes
it's
a
20,
while.
20 people.
That could take a while.
There
it is.
Right? So you're laying there. Everybody's just chilling out. Are you talking and conversing with them? Or are you just
I'm laughing.
Like
not too much. Sometimes I did. Like there, you tell in that movement I was talking. See the way the sushi jumped up on my diaphragm? I was probably talking.
Let's get a little more audio of this here.
I am a fresh plate of hunger to devour.
That was the last line.
That John Law?
No.
I thought I saw a mustache. It was sushi in his mouth.
Blake, I love your phrasing.
Oh yeah.
The way your poems run. You know, it's your pauses and the length of line. It's very soothing. Your phrasing is very soothing.
Thank you. That's really nice.
Yeah. Well, as I was saying earlier, the way we met was Blake coming into Radio Free Burning Man and asking if she could read some poems. Was that 95?
It was 96.
96. Can I read some poems? Yeah, of course.
Yeah, that was the year that year was so fun for me because I was just, you know, wandering around. I had all these poems memorized, and so I was just going around, you know. And I think the sisters dressed me like Dead Marilyn, and I always like a poem about beauty. But this is what's really funny. So at the end of this is the story that made me think about this. So all those people like ate. It like took like 2 hours, and the lead in, I cooked all the food. I made all the sushi. So the day before,
Whoa.
I did everything. Whoa. And then the 4 ladies who did me up, who like, you know, laid me out and dressed me, they came to the Oddfellow Lodge early to the kitchen where we had, and we actually did all the rolls and did everything. So afterwards, everybody had eaten and, you know, okay, I'm done. I'm going to get up. And I got up and like everyone, you know, and there's going to be a little thing at the very end, a big clap, you know, and I stood up on the table and I'm still, you know, naked. And I like made a comment about bringing in the silver tray. And people start looking at me like, oh my God, what is she going to do? You know, and I start talking about how, well, in Japan, there's this ritual. So this is where I'm like, you know, like totally finally can talk after 2 hours,
and
you know,
eat.
Which anyone who knows me knows how hard it is for me to keep my mouth shut at all. I'm like, oh no. So I stood up and told them about this experience of there's kind of another weird Japanese sex cults kind of thing about, you know, picture yourself in a high rise in Shinjuku, you know, the glass windows, penthouse, high rise, and there's a black lacquer table, and there's 20 people sitting around the table, and it's exquisitely set with silver, and there's no food on the table. All there is a silver platter in the middle of the long table. And this beautiful woman walks in with a kimono on, and she's helped onto the table, and she goes in the middle of the table over the platter, and then she squats and takes a shit on the silver platter, and then she's dismissed and she goes away, and then they all divide it up and then they eat it. And it's like she's like a veal, you know, like she's fed and she's quarantined for a long period of time and fed special food so that they notice the flavors and so this is the story I told all those guys after they just finished eating on me. And I'm standing there, and everyone like, and people told me later, like, oh no, you're like, is this what's next? Like, oh my God, is this the sorbet?
That's perfect.
You know, so luckily I was, yeah.
Wait, you're making that story up?
I know, it's true. Really, I read that in the Pink Samurai book. That was another Pink Samurai.
But you're telling them the story, and of course they're thinking, right, oh my God, she's about to do this right
like,
now.
Like, oh my God, yeah. Like,
then you're like, okay, thank you all, good night.
Yeah.
I got the OP.
And I remember one time in Japan, I had a lot of like really interesting encounters with men that were kind of an odd sexual nature, of like predator nature, you know, because the men are predators on the trains. And one time I was reading, you know, thinking, here I am in Japan, no one knows, I'm reading the Marquis de Sade, and and I'm sitting there like reading, you know, and it was one of those, you know, and this guy, this young Japanese kid, comes on, and he like sees what I'm reading, and I'm like holding the pole, you know, with my book reading, and it was definitely in like a super kinky part. I'm just like, you know, five people and everything's filled, and I'm like, oh my God, I'm reading this. And he, this guy like bumps into me. And I was just kind of like, and he starts like just rubbing into me and looking at me like with this look, like it is like, oh. And I looked at my book and I was like, oh wow, he knows what I'm reading, you know, like, oh, you know. And I closed my book and went somewhere else. But it was so funny, you know, just because of I was surprised by that. That was usually the men were more passive, or they were aggressive. But as soon as I made any, you know, hint of not wanting it, they just ran, you know.
It seems to be a really subversive passive culture.
Yes.
You know, and it's like in business too. You've read a lot of business. I mean, that was the height of their business culture when Americans were emulating Japanese business, and it was all intermeshing. And
totally.
It's a subversive thing where you drink sake at a certain time, people don't say anything until a certain time, and you could ruin a business deal by sneezing at the wrong time.
Yeah, right, and they'd shame you.
Totally.
So you're saying that if the men are attempting to gain your favor and you... and you show them that you're not interested, they will leave. They will go find someone else.
Well,
or if you're like, if you're aggressive, they don't like that either.
Yeah, like one of the stories that I like telling was another one of these train stories where I was leaned back on a chair with a friend, and I had my legs kind of spread, and it was, you know, I was just leaning back and talking to him, and this salaryman-ish guy, and it was, of course, this usually a lot of this happens after the alcohol, like, you know, after the trains all stop running at midnight, so there's kind of a controlled set of time when you can go get wasted, and everyone pretty much, you know, on those late trains going home, you know, there's a lot of drunk people on the train, so there's more interaction. And this guy came, and I had my legs a little bit spread, leaning back, and he stood right in between my legs, like stood and held the ring and kind of like looked over me. And I was like, and I looked at my friend, I'm like, hey, Daniel, watch this. And I like squeezed, like I brought my knees around him and like just squeezed at him and gave him a little wink. And he just backed up and just like got, oh, you know. And it was like, I scared him by calling his bluff.
Crazy.
This is kind of fun to do stuff like
that.
I did a lot of weird
say,
street theater when I was there.
He wants to say no.
Yeah, exactly. No.
You can write a book of train stories.
I think so, and that would be great to see. I'd buy that. But I want to buy this one, and for our listeners again, tell us the name, publisher, and you say by mid-November.
By mid-November. It's called God Meat, and it will be available. It's going to be small press distribution, so I think it'll be pretty easy to find, and you can
maybe Modern Times might have it.
Modern Times might have it. I'm not sure. I think this is the part that it depends on what's going on with Beatitude and how good they are okay. at that kind of stuff. I'm always lousy at the actual marketing.
How about
I'm
your
much
website?
Better. Yeah, my website, it's definitely available.
And tell us your website address, please.
It's snakelyone, snakelyone.com.
Snakelyone.com.
Snakely.
And any listeners out there, you can go on my MySpace, and I already posted it on there. So
There you go. A link.
There it is.
Yeah, that's much easier than trying to remember Snakelyone.
Or even on my blogger, you know, all that jazz.
Yeah,
I post.
Yeah, and I've been wanting to update my site for so long. I don't have a blog or anything, but I should because I'm writing so much work.
So much work. It's like
a daily exercise.
Every day. Yeah. I mean, I do. I write every day anyway.
And what is, as a writer, you know, what is your schedule or your discipline? You write 3 pages a day at in the morning, 15 pages a day.
How do you
By the end of the day, do you have something, you know, for aspiring writers?
I used to. When I was an aspiring writer, I made myself, there was a period of time where I had to write a poem a day. And if it was just a draft, that was okay. It wasn't have to be a perfect poem, but I had to do a poem every single day in every journal entry. And I would write in my journal every day. I used to only keep one journal. Now I have three. I have like a little pad that I take with me out to clubs, you know, when I don't know if I'm going to be bored or if I get an idea or whatever. At least
something
I have
that fits
something
in your pocket.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And then I have one by my bed. So when I used to get a lot, I don't get it as much, but I used to get like voice, like I'd wake up in the middle of the night. Like there, I remember once is open the window to your mind. Oh, I can't remember. Open the window to your mind and your dreams will follow or something like that. Something like that. And the other one was, everybody's listening. And I know, yeah, God, I can't remember them right now. My brain. It's a little.
You've been talking a lot.
That's why you write things down.
That's why I write things down. But then I have one that I keep in my purse.
Yeah.
And but now I'm editing a book for a friend, and I've just finished with this book. So I've been much more in edit mode than original mode. But you know, I still
to call from.
I do appreciate the question though about the idea for aspiring writers, because there are a lot of writers out there that don't understand that it's a practice. You can't just up and start.
Mm-mm.
Having it pour out. So what can you say for aspiring writers out there? Some suggestions.
I mean, the two things that were always that I teach poetry in the classrooms. Also, I work with California poets in the schools. So I do like poetry artists and residencies at different schools in Mendocino County. And sometimes I come down and do work here, but mostly that's like as a visiting teacher mm-hmm. for other poets. But I always tell students, read and write.
Yeah.
You know, you got to read so you can know what else is out there, and you have to write. But I also think that the reading part, you know, like the reading with an open mind, my favorite poet is Rumi.
Ah, yeah.
And Rumi is one of those poets that's able to strip away everything. And that essence that lies within the words and that mystery that is able to sneak between every syllable, that's what I'm aiming for. Even though like this poem that I just told, like Odakusin, is just a story. There's not really a lot of that in there, but I really try to keep the soul where you can feel the soul within the poem all the time. Does that make sense?
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Cause you can feel it. It has a life.
Yeah.
The poetry has a life.
I like the phrase that you used, the mystery between the symbol.
Yeah, like I think I said syllable, but
syllable.
That, yeah.
Yeah, I mean syllable, yeah. And that goes with your phrasing, too, and it's where you put your punctuation, how you say your words, how long you keep a pause, keeps the mystery going. It makes somebody want to hear more, makes the story more, it gives a story of a voice of its own.
Exactly, and I think there's a poem in here that... it's kind of new. It's really new. And it's kind of talks about that. Maybe it talks a little bit about a part of the, it's called Sky Eye, and it's got that feeling of the spiritual, you know, that mystery and that place of, you know, the human trying to figure out what it's, I don't really like have a practice per se, other than just I want to keep learning and keep expanding, and I try as hard as I can not to stay too fixed on one form or idea of what I think it is, and just like let it keep showing me. And this poem is kind of about that. Sky Eye. After a fit of cart And I'll start again. Poem. After a fit of cartwheels, I tumble onto our meadow. The twilight expanse wobbles, drawing my eyes along edges of the cobalt net that keeps me from flying into black. I watch an invisible wheel etch diamonds into patterns along memories fed by the born and dying, the poets and insane. I long to pull the gleaming shards into an unbroken blanket of light, sleep in brilliance until I wake up dreaming, my story merged so only volumes of breath remain. This body is a prison. It is a temple. I cannot keep myself away from longing for warm hands and the faraway sky that looks at you the way it looks at me. My hunger sticks to everything like lily pollen in a handful of hummingbirds. I was homesick yesterday, vulnerable, like always, begging for answers. But today came. I remembered cracks in the surges of mystery. How to step in between and buy bananas and avocados. Jupiter hovers above Scorpio, big and blue, pale spiral silent alongside, reminding that it is me who taunts, tortures with relentless cruelty, the need to know greater than the need for love. I give in to the sky, willing, never too sure, dazed, but not confused. I love you smiling at me. You're so beautiful. God, like, wow, I forgot what I was doing.
That was excellent. Pirate Cat Radio, 87.9 FM in San Francisco and Los Angeles, 104.8 in Berlin, online at piratecatradio.com. John Hell is my name. Hi, thanks. Ice Cream Lopez along here as well. Season in Hell is the show. Blake Moore in the studio. Thank you so much for coming.
Oh, so nice. I've really enjoyed being here. Thank
what
you.
An absolute pleasure
this has been.
You are so bright, and you are an absolute ray of sunshine on the brightest days.
Thanks.
So thank you for being here. And you know, you're up in Mendocino, up in Point Arena. And can folks up in that area see you perform on a regular basis?
You know, I think somewhat for me in Mendocino, it's a small town where I live, and I do the poetry readings once a month, and I always, you know, bring in poets. That's my job, to
where?
Hire the poets. It's at the, well, we used to have a city art gallery. It was a gallery that we had for 10 years, and I have been on the board of it for 9 of those 10, and we just closed. We paid $1 a year for rent.
Oh, nice.
We had an amazing patron, and he died. And so now that he's died, the building's for sale, and we can't afford the $1,000 a month. Like, we were really a community art gallery, and we didn't have to. It was a clubhouse for artists, and it was wonderful. And now the series will go on. There's another gallery down the street, Think Visual, that wants to have it, and the library wants to have it, and then the cafe offered to have it. So it's still alive. We're not going to die. But I perform, like, recently Dan Hicks was in town, and the people who produced that show had me do, like, a weird performance piece in the beginning where I played a stewardess, and there was a voiceover part, and I was kind of a stewardess, like a pillbox hat, a little funny suit, and the voiceover got more and more absurd about the things we were supposed to do to get ready for our flight. And so suddenly, you know, I've got one foot up, and then I'm jumping on one foot, and then I got to put both legs behind my head, and I'm like, you know, the blonde wig, like trying to do all this stuff and falling over, but like actually doing it, because, you know, I can put my feet behind my head because I do a lot of yoga and that sort of stuff. So it's kind of like an odd routine. So stuff like that happens just a lot. Like, someone will say to me, hey, will you do this? But I'm not really actively. That's why I think I've moved into film, because up there I'm kind of old hat. Like, everyone's seen me a million times. It's like, oh, Blake, oh gosh, she's gonna do something. And some people were, you know, really like it, but it's not like the city where there's always, we have at the Oddfellow Lodge, the Mendocino 420 Lodge, we do our cabaret shows that are like twice or three times a year, and I help put those on, and those are really fun. It's like full variety, you know, kind of like, not yeah, it's like, you know, I mean, I used to love the Odeon, you know, that was as a cabaret, that was probably one of the highest cabarets in the most absurd lowbrow way, you
absolutely
know, that I really miss that
so much. much fun.
Right.
The clubhouse. So, I mean, mostly I'm performing this weekend at the Baby Beat Festival in Oakland. Great. And that's at the Fellowship Hall. Do you know where that is? Yeah, I don't have my information right.
Well, we can,
I think
you know
it
what?
Might be on my website.
We'll get it and we'll post it up on Pirate Cat Radio's website, so piratecatradio.com.
It's called the Baby Beat Festival.
Yeah, okay. So there's
if you're looking in any of the papers or anything,
you'll find it.
Across.
Yeah.
We'll get it
yeah.
up there.
Yeah, there's a bunch of poets that are going to be part of that.
Good.
Yeah.
And that's in Oakland.
And
this
that's
weekend.
In Oakland. This weekend.
So that
Oakland.
So I want to ring a full circle as we end tonight. Now you are a writer. You are a performer. You are a filmmaker. That's what you are. That's what you do.
Yeah.
That's what you find. And that's where you find your happiness in your life.
Yeah.
That's where the wealth comes in your life.
Yeah. And there. And also the fact that I can look up and see all of the stars in the Milky
yeah,
Way
yeah,
and
yeah.
shooting stars. I mean, I live in a really, really beautiful place. Right. And I think that the peace of where I live gives me another kind of, it gives me a silence inside that allows that, all that to come out in some way. And I'm a loner. So that is all like the nature for me is just a really easy place to find that.
Yeah.
So all those things are true. And I think, I don't know if I would have them all if it weren't for where I live, you know, does that make sense?
Yes.
Yeah.
And from what you've gone through,
yeah,
you know, you've certainly been able to see what the alternative can be. And you chose it.
Also being in a place in your life where you're confident about the choices that you make and that you're making, and to just say, this is what I need, this is what I want, and here I am, and I'm just going to do it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And not
yeah.
constantly questioning where you are or who you are because you've gone through so much.
Yeah, that's true. You know, that's the kind of self-acceptance.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Right on.
Yeah. Well, thank you guys. It was really fun. I loved it. Thanks for listening to my poetry.
Snakelyone.com is the website. Please do check it out. It's a great site. Update it eventually. You're fine with that, right?
Yeah, I keep, you know, I update it, but